Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, today on Ira's Everything Bagel, we're going to be talking about identity, belonging, and the stories that shape who we become. My guest is Michael Isaac Chokrian. He's an award-winning writer whose debut novel, American Playground, takes us deep into the cultural crossroads of 1970s Los Angeles, a time and place where assimilation, family, and self-discovery collide in deeply human ways. Michael's work doesn't just tell a story, it asks important questions about what it means to find your place in the world while holding on to where you come from. Beyond his own writing, he's also the editor behind The Thieving Magpie, a nonprofit digital quarterly that's giving voice to emerging and unrepresented writers from around the globe. This is a conversation about art, identity, and the responsibility of storytelling in a complex world. American Playground is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about Michael, go to michaelchokrian.com. Try saying that three times real fast. And follow him on Substack, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And I should probably spell it. That would probably help as well. Chokrian. And you can also go visit thethievingmagpie.org. We'll get into that as well. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Pleasure. So before we get into the book itself, you are so many other things before you even got into the book. And so you have an interesting backstory or background. I like background better than backstory. Backstory sounds way too Hollywood. So you have an interesting background. Why don't you share with our audience, both viewers and listeners, about your background moving to Los Angeles, growing up in Los Angeles in the 70s, but where you come from, what made you as a man, and I'll shut up now and let you talk.
Okay, thank you. Well, I was born in Hamburg, Germany. My parents lived there for a brief period of time. My parents are both from Iran. When I was still an infant, they moved us back to Tehran, where I spent the first almost 7 years of my life. And then for strictly family reasons, we moved from Iran to Los Angeles. We had other family members here. And I grew up in L.A., an L.A. kid in the 70s. Mm-hmm. I went to L.A. public schools. I went to UCLA undergrad, where I fell in love with writing. I was an English major, loved Shakespeare, loved American literature, spent a lot of time reading, working in the library there. When I graduated, I with a BA in English, I went to San Francisco State University for the creative writing program there, continued my writing. Then I bounced around for many years trying to make it as a writer. I had many jobs. Different jobs just to support myself. I was kind of on the outs with my family, who are a very traditional Persian Jewish family who did not approve of me pursuing the arts. And when I turned 30, I figured out that maybe, not that they're right, but I wasn't making it as a writer. So I applied to law school, went to law school at age 31, 10 years older than everybody else there. Got my degree, got my law degree, passed the bar exam, you know, had this intention of practicing law as a side gig for my writing career. But of course, those plans always, fall apart when you fall in love with somebody. I fell in love with somebody. I got married, had kids. Suddenly, the writing became a side gig. And the lawyering became the actual thing. And that happened for quite a while until I almost lost my mind. And my wife and I agreed that I could spend, 4 hours, 4 billable hours a day pursuing my writing. So I got back into writing after our second kid was born, and I just pursued it. And that's around the time when I started up the Thieving Magpie magazine as a platform for other writers, because I know how it is to get rejected. I know how it is to send out stories. I was originally a short story writer, and I used to send stuff out all the time. I got tons of rejections. It hurts. And so I thought that I could be a kinder and gentler editor and publisher with The Thieving Magpie. I mean, I still have to reject people.
Sure.
But I love seeing new work. I love seeing young writers. Some of them are old, by the way, but new writers It's a thrill to publish them and to have a platform for them, and they are thrilled to be part of it. So it's a very rewarding experience.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more in a few minutes about The Thieving Magpie and your approach to stories in that. But getting back just for a second to your background, I like the way you said you grew up in L.A. Technically, if you want to be correct, that you grew up in the Valley.
I grew up in L.A. I live in the Valley now.
Oh, okay. So at the time, you were what part of L.A. were you growing up in that wasn't the Valley then? I just want to
West L.A. Okay. West L.A. Cheviot Hills.
All right. Yep. Okay.
Rancho Park area. That's what we call it, Rancho Park.
Okay. Yeah. I got the impression from initially reading about you that it was all in the Valley. That's why I wanted to differentiate, but I see what you're saying now. So
yeah,
it's fine. How did you get the idea for American Playground? Again, this is a novel. This is your debut novel. I shouldn't even ask the question. It's clearly based on your experience growing up in L.A., which I alluded to in the opening. But how did you get the idea maybe to flesh it out, to approach it the way that you did?
Okay, so the way that I had originally done it was that I had three short stories that happened to have connecting narrators and characters. So they were sort of connected, but they were not the same. They were just three separate short stories. And I was writing a collection of short stories. I had about 10 or 11 short stories that were well edited and I thought well written and ready to be packaged as a collection. I spoke with an editor who dabbles in publishing. And he advised me to abandon the short story as a debut because most debut writers don't do short story collections. He advised me to write a novel, try to write a novel. And I'd never written a novel before. So I strung these three stories, these short stories together because there was enough similarity of characters and theme. And I built the novel around those short stories. And it was a real experience for me because, again, I really consider myself a short story writer. I love the art form of the short story. And so getting into novel was a real challenge. And also, I respect novelists, and I didn't even like dare to think that I could do what they do. So it was a learning experience. And you know, it worked out actually, because I realized I have a lot to say around those three stories because they were all very personal, and so it flowed pretty easily to expand and to create a theme and some sort of a run through, or what do they call it, through line. Mm-hmm. it was a fun experience.
Well, so, if you mind sharing with us what those themes in general terms were for the three different stories that ended up becoming the novel.
The first one was a story called Recess. And it was a short story that I first wrote when I was at UCLA, and it got published in the UCLA's literary magazine. And it was about my first days in America. It was about a kid who was 4 days into America, starting the second semester of second grade, not knowing any words, any English words other than the seven words that he had learned when he was in special English class back in Tehran.
Which is not George Carlin's seven words.
What's that? No, not George. Yeah.
Okay.
Not George Carlin.
All right. Okay.
Basic seven words. And so Recess was a story about this seven-year-old kid in second grade who is just learning his surroundings, basically. Learning where he is, what he's in for, trying to learn the language of the students around him and trying to speak like them and trying to understand them and a lot of questions that he had. That story ended up in the ending of that story is that he gets into a fight on the tetherball court with a kid and he thinks that's going to elevate him. But of course it doesn't. So that was the first story. Then there was a second story that was entitled Beaner Boy. And it was about that same character a couple of years later, still in elementary school, in Los Angeles in the early 70s, before the revolution, before, all the hoopla, Iran was not really on the map in the American culture. So nobody knew where that was or what it was. They just saw me as a dark-skinned kid in Los Angeles, so they assumed I was Mexican. So I earned the nickname of Beaner Boy, and that stuck. That stuck for my life through elementary school and part of middle school. And so this, the second one, was a story about Beaner Boy and trying to shake what the stigma of being called a Mexican was, because in those days it was a slur. They were not saying it to you in a fun way. They were saying it to you in a negative way. And he kept trying to convince these kids that he's a cool guy. He's, you know, he's like them. And of course he wasn't like them. He just wanted to be like them a lot. So that was Beaner Boy. And then there was another story called Bike, about that same character getting his bike stolen, a bike that he cherished and that he fought for to get. So those were the stories that started it out and that became the framework for the novel.
Well, the themes are obviously deeper than how you explained it just now, and rightly so. But thank you for giving us a sense of the background to the novel. The most important question I have to ask, and if you say no, I'll be very surprised, is did you run the book by your wife after you wrote it?
She read it.
Okay. I mean, did she give you some good criticism, or did she say that she enjoyed it, or she didn't like it at all? Or
yeah, you know, the first draft of the book was significantly different from this final draft, but all the things that are in this final draft are in that first draft, and I gave it to her, and she spent many nights reading it. By herself. I was upstairs biting my nails and trying to, but I could hear her laughing. And I could hear her, you know, a lot of guffaws and a lot of big yeah. laughs coming out of her. So I knew I was hitting something, you know, but of course I don't trust her judgment, because she's my wife. She loves me. And, you know, she has a kind ear. So as much as she loved it, I didn't know how it was going to be received once it really got out there.
To balance her out, you gave the next draft over to an enemy.
I gave the draft to an editor.
Okay, who's more objective in essence? So
much more objective, okay. And he tore it apart, and you know, he gave me some basic elemental frameworks of how novels work.
Right.
Which I learned. I mean, I understood what the flaws were, and it took a lot of work. It took a lot more work revising and rewriting it than writing it was.
A lot of billable hours going by as you.
A lot of billable hours going by. Correct.
Oh man, I don't know. Your support of your wife is great, based on all of what you're telling us now. So
yeah.
I like the title of the book. I'll tell you why, because it plays on a lot of different levels. I'm not sure when you came up with it, whether you're aware of it or not, but it's an American playground, because it's your story in novel form about being on a playground, but that there's a lot of other connotations, cultural connotations and historical connotations from that title.
Yes. Yes.
So I like your choice of that. Did you find that other people react to it the way I just did, or?
Yeah, they did, because I think that the playground has its own hierarchy of, you know, who's on top and who's on bottom. And there's a constant struggle on that playground for people on the bottom to try to get to the top, and people at the top to try to keep those people at the bottom. There are a lot of rules, and there are a lot of unwritten rules. And you really have to navigate all of that in order to just make it through the day. And so I thought that, yes, the book is physically about a kid on a playground, but it is to me a metaphor of how you become an American, and the platform upon which you have to negotiate and navigate to become an American. And also you can have a lot of fun there. It's a playful place, but it's also a hard place. It's concrete, it's asphalt, it's a lot of bars and metal, and you can hurt your back and your head and your heart. In the process.
That way, I think they've made it so childproof now that you can't hurt yourself no matter what. But
correct.
Anyway, yeah. But here's the thing, though, I get from you, and that is Yes, it is absolutely true. It's hard. Yes, it's hard also to assimilate or to take parts of what you want to take from your American experience. But at the end of the day, everybody has an opportunity, if they work hard, use their brains, use their energy to become successful as you did. So not only are you a writer, but you're an attorney, you have a wonderful family, etc. So the lesson I take from it is that nothing's easy in life, but if it's going to be hard, it might be better to be hard in America than it would be in some other countries in the world.
Of course, America is still a place where you can beat some of those unwritten rules and get past some of the obstacles that every country has. Even America has obstacles, but given all the different options, I think yeah, being here in this country, a person that can step onto the playground not knowing the language or the rules. Can figure it out and can get to where not only where he thinks he wants to go, but where he should go and want and realizes he wants to go. And that's part of the novel as well, because you think you want certain things and you fight to get those towards those things that you think you want. And then you kind of realize actually, the things that you wanted weren't really what they seem to be, and it's much easier to be who you are, accept who you are, and that gets you to the place that you really are supposed to be at.
Have you had any reaction from? I know there's a large Persian community in Los Angeles. Not that you
Yes.
know everybody personally, but the fact that you're now an author and you have the novel, have you had feedback from Persian friends or relatives that have read the novel, and have they reacted in a way you thought they would react, or perhaps they reacted more positively than you thought they would, or more negatively than you thought they would?
I haven't gotten any. Nobody's said to me personally that there was anything negative about it.
Well, they're talking to me about it, Michael.
exactly. So I don't know what they're saying behind my back.
I made that up.
I think that first of all, the community, and I am part of a big community, a Persian community and a Persian Jewish community inside of that Persian community. They are very proud and very excited whenever one of us gets it out there and recognizes us as ourselves for who we are. So when their culture is being represented, they embrace that and they enjoy seeing it. A lot of them enjoyed the Farsi language that's interlaced in the whole book, and that was a conscious decision I made to let the Farsi exist alongside the American or English words without any italics or rabbit ears or whatever you call that, quotes. Because I wanted American readers and Iranian readers to see the same words and hear the same sounds. I made that conscious decision because I figured that there was probably a time 50 or 70 years ago when a lot of Italian or Chinese or other nationalities, their words were foreign and now they're common to us, And I thought that Iranians have been here for over 50 years and maybe now we're entitled to un-italicize our language and to have it sit next to American words. Because that's what we are.
So you're thinking that Farsi could be the new Yiddish, that it could be English language.
Maybe the new Yiddish, maybe the new,
Pestle anyway. So okay, fair enough. What was the most surprising thing that you discovered in writing this novel once you gave it to your wife to read, and others, of course, you got some feedback. Then you gave it to the editor, who then put you through the mill and all those billable hours being wasted rewriting. Okay. What was the most surprising thing you discovered for yourself about the finished novel?
I was surprised that I finished it. I mean, honestly, I was surprised that I was able to get to what I thought was an ending that I really wanted to get to, and I didn't know that I had what it takes to get to that ending that I really wanted to see. So that was rewarding for me. It is rewarding. I mean, I had been told by others before that finishing a novel is an accomplishment all by itself, whether it's good or not. So that part of it was very satisfying. But also the process of justifying that ending, what editors call an earned ending, what the character had to go through to get to that ending, I wasn't prepared for as a writer. And it took a lot of hard work or, inner searches to really get to the ugly, and from that ugly get to what he learns and what he understands and gets to that ending. So writing a novel is hard, and
No doubt about it. I can always recognize hard work when somebody can write a book, whether it's a novel or a nonfiction book. It's a lot of work. So anybody, I admire people that can do that. I want to talk to you a little bit about the Thieving Magpie, and when did it start, and has it exceeded your expectations in a way of being a repository for talent that's not recognized, for want of a better term, in the mainstream of literary America?
The Thieving Magpie, many, many years ago, I thought that I was going to open up a bookstore and call it the Thieving Magpie Booksellers. And I was never able to, put it together and get it done. But the idea of being in a literary space called the Thieving Magpie has always been in the back of my mind. In 2017, well, in 2017 is when I finally managed to get it all together. And I think the real reason I did it was because after getting so many rejections so frequently, I really thought that I'm going to create this magazine for my own writing, to put my own writing in there, because I wanted a platform, to show my work.
Sure. In essence, almost a Substack situation.
Exactly. Before Substack existed, but I was doing it for selfish reasons. That's the truth. But once I got the website up and running, and once I set it up with a submissions portal, once I got an artist to do the logo, which I love, and put it out there, and once I got the submissions, everything changed, because then I realized, there are some really talented people from all over the world who are looking for a place to just park their art and to have their art be seen. And by the second issue or third issue, my work didn't appear anywhere in the magazine. It still doesn't, only just as an editorial when I do an editorial. But otherwise, it's everybody else. I started getting submissions very frequently, very rapidly, and so it became its own thing. I didn't expect to get any submission. I don't even know how people find out about it, because I'm not a marketing person. I mean, I put it up on poetsandwriters.org and different platforms, to have it accessible. But I do get a lot of great writers and poets and photographers and essayists and all of them. And they come from everywhere. They come from Australia, they come from China, they come from Eastern Europe, they come from Nebraska, Oklahoma. They're everywhere. Good writers are everywhere. And it became.
Begin, Michael, in different languages? Submissions are
No,
English.
they all write English.
Okay.
This one young woman from the Philippines, there was a language barrier. It was clear in the writing. And sometimes I write back and I just let them know that, look, I get what the story is about. She needs to work on it and, figure out if she wants to do it in English or in a different language. Maybe our magazine's not the one for whatever. But I wanted her to understand that I got it. I saw her. I read her work. And she's on the right track. And but of course, it's an English language
Right.
magazine. I can't hire somebody to read other languages.
Do you have a kinder, gentler rejection slip that you send people than the ones you used to get?
Yes, than what I used to get, for sure. I mean, you know, honestly, the best rejection letter I ever got was from the New Yorker, and they were very kind, and in handwriting. It was handwriting. So that was a real thing. I was very proud of that one. Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, first of all, you have to read the stories. And we're a one-man operation right now. I mean, I have people that do other things, but not editorial stuff. I read all that stuff myself.
Right.
So that if I reject it, I'm doing it for a real reason. And when I accept it, I'm also accepting it for a real reason. So, you know, yeah, I give them small amount of feedback, not a lot, because, you know, this happened to me when I was a young writer as well, is that if you get any sort of feedback that's beyond rejection, sometimes you take that and say, okay, well, what can I do better? What did you not like? And so that becomes a whole, you know, other business.
Yeah,
called being an editor.
Before I let you go, what would you want readers to take away from American Playground?
I think the lesson in the American Playground is on the page one from Mr. Wizard of the Tudor Turtle cartoons, which is always be what you is, not what you is not. And I think that's the lesson. The lesson is that we, all of us, go through life trying to please others or trying to be what others want us to be, because we think that's the road to acceptance. And really, you can't hide from yourself. You can't avoid who you are. And the lesson is embrace it. Embrace what you are, warts and all. You will have a much better existence and attract those things that you think you want to attract by being who you are, not trying to pretend to be somebody else, because it never works.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Michael Isaac Shokrian. He's author of American Playground and editor of The Thieving Magpie. American Playground is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about Michael, go to mishokrian.com and follow him on Substack, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And you can also visit thethievingmagpie.org. And Michael, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.